Thank you. It's always a great sorrow to whoever is standing up here to see the front rows empty. But I suppose it's better that the kids are out where they are than with us. Lisa and Leanne, I suppose I've got to know much better over the last few weeks when we've been talking about this service and how we want to share in it and talk about our faith as Christians. Our lives are very different in so many ways. I now have grandchildren. Lisa has grown up children, and Leanne is still moulding them. And with Paul's help, of course. Sorry about that, Paul. But so we have very different experiences of what it is to be an adult and to be a Christian. And but before we talk about that issue, what I would like to do is to ask them a few questions and find out just a little bit about them. So do you guys mind coming up and I'll do the cross-examination. Hello, am I on? Yes, on. Okay, I'll stand here because when I do cross-examinations in court, you always like to be slightly higher than the witness or the person to whom you're talking, you know. It's called the bullying tactic, but of course, we don't do that. We do this in love here this morning, and the questions will all be sensitive. I was warned when I spoke to someone that I was inviting two young women from Northern Ireland to come and share the platform with me. He said, well, I hope you're going to have lots of time. The one thing about a woman from Northern Ireland is she can fair make a short story long. So we have plenty of time this morning for your answers, and I'd be happy to listen. What I wonder is, can I maybe just ask each of you, you've given us a bit of background. Lisa, you've talked about having a husband called Jim, and you've got three kids. Why are you in Scotland?
Oh, gastroenteritis.
Well, maybe for the non-medics, you could explain what that is.
I'm not going to do that. I planned to be a primary school teacher, but the Lord delivered both me and the primary school children of Northern Ireland in that I was ill during my A-levels. And, I had my head down a toilet while I should have been sitting a history exam, so I only got two A-levels. And Aberdeen University said, come on down. So I went to Aberdeen and did English instead of going to Stranmillis and doing teaching. Stranmillis is a teacher training college in Belfast. And while I was at Aberdeen, I got roped into cooking for SU camps where I met Jim. So having married a Scotsman, we stayed in Scotland. And so our boys are Alistair, in the Gaelic spelling, Angus, in the anglicised spelling, because that was more easy, and Rory, whom you know.
So, Jim is Scottish then, is he?
Yes, believe it or not. But while he was at All Nations Christian College, he shared a room with a chap from Kalinchi. So he started picking it up there. It's not all my fault he speaks the way he does.
So it was love that brought you over here?
Absolutely.
I'm delighted. Now, Leanne, your story is slightly different because you married an Irishman.
No. Paul is from Edinburgh, even though he tries to deny it at every opportunity.
Well, of course, Edinburgh. We don't understand his accent over here. Tell us how you met Paul.
So we were at a wedding. I knew the groom. Paul knew the bride. I very much like the best man, but... met Paul instead, and the rest is history. And Paul lived in Aberdeen, I lived in Dublin. There happened to be direct flights at that stage from Dublin to Aberdeen, so eventually, after lots of twists and turns, I moved over. Couldn't live in Aberdeen because it was too far from anything, and so we came here.
I see, right. Tell us about your first date, because it seems to me, I mean, I remember my first date with Moira. It was in a philosophy class. I was the lout at the back, rolling pennies down to try and distract the lecturer. and Maura was the keenie fresher writing everything down on the front row. So that was where we met. How did you meet Paul?
So we met at that wedding, and that wedding was our first date.
And was that your first date? Did you have a date after that?
But you see, then after that, it was a sort of long-term relationship where I would go across to Aberdeen and, yeah, it's not, that bit isn't very interesting, I have to tell
you. It wasn't interesting. Paul, is that how you remember it? Was it as interesting as that?
Yeah, it was dull as dishwater, it really was.
I'll try not to embarrass you too much. Lisa, tell us about your first date with...
First date with Jim. Do you know, this is very romantic. I hope you've got a hanky. Do you need a hanky?
I don't need a hanky, no, no. I don't cry. Lawyers never cry.
Heart of stone.
Heartless.
Jim sent me the one and only genuine, absolutely I don't know who this is from, Valentine card I ever had in my life. He was just home from Nepal and trying to find his feet back in Scotland. And we'd been corresponding, because when I met him, he was home on furlough. And so we'd been corresponding another distance. Wasn't really a relationship at that point. I was praying for him. It was the Christian Union in Aberdeen, covered the world in prayer every week. And I was part of a prayer group that prayed for India and Nepal, Bhutan, and these places. So we had that link, you know. And so when he came home, I was all excited, and he had tried to be in touch. He near put my mother's head away by phoning from Thailand, and Mum couldn't get the idea of the delay with the satellite, so they just talked over each other while I was at college. So then he sent this Valentine and invited me over to see the Mikado at the King's Theatre that was being performed by the Orpheus Club. Anybody remember the Orpheus Club? They did Gilbert and Sullivan for years and years and years, and his dad was involved in that. He wasn't on stage that night. But as we crossed the road after the performance to try and find the car, and we looked up at the Mitchell Library, his hand slipped into mine.
Oh, now I'm crying.
So there you go. That was our first date.
Excellent. Now, one of the problems of being interviewed by a lawyer is that he is niggling to find the things that have gone wrong in your life. Sure, do you admit guilt? But we've all made mistakes. I have to confess, I have made a few mistakes in my life. But sometimes our mistakes have a real funny story behind them. Leanne, have you and Paul got into a funny situation?
I travel quite a lot for work, either across to Edinburgh or to London, and very often when I come in late, when I come in to Glasgow, I'm then running to do a pickup, and so I have to gather, you know, my coat, and my phone, and my bag, and my laptop, my lunch, whatever, gather it all together and run to get a bus to get kids. And this one day I was particularly stressed, gathered it all together and realised I didn't have my phone. Quite unlike me. I stood up as the train was getting into Glasgow and said, "People, I have lost my phone. It is in this carriage. You must help me find it." And about a dozen people started, you know, checking it overhead and on the floor and down the side. And this one woman said, "Give me your number and I'll phone you." So she phoned my phone and I would shout, "I can hear it. It's here somewhere." And people are still looking for it, and eventually the cleaner comes on the train and she said, "This train is leaving in 2 minutes to go back to Edinburgh. You're gonna have to get off." So we all get off and I can see the stranger still phoning the phone. I'm saying, "It's there, it's there." And the cleaner came up to me and she said, "Are you sure it's not in your pocket?" And I said, "No." But it was in my pocket.
Excellent. Lisa, what about you? Do you have fun when you make mistakes?
I tend to get very annoyed with myself when I make mistakes, actually, which is bad. I know I should laugh. I don't know if you know, I was at school with Janet McKinnon. Yes, we were exactly the same class at school. She's younger than me, I should say, just in, you know, in fairness. But we played hockey And you can see the size of me. They put me in goal. Great idea. My mother was terrified I was going to get very badly damaged by this hockey experience, so she insisted that I have a face mask, which in those days wasn't a helmet with a grid. It looked like a skeleton face and was solid. So there was eye holes. You know, that's quite difficult when you're trying to see your feet. She also insisted that I have a chest protector. This was built for somebody twice my size and twice my height. So on the first day, I wore this face mask that came down to here and this chest protector, which came up to here. I tried to see the ball that came at me. Up went the protector, up went the mask. I could see nothing, and I stood on the ball. Stand up like that? No, not like that, like this. And I landed on the ground, and the ball disappeared because the pads that I was wearing were twice the size of my legs, and all these players were going like, where is the ball? And I was sitting on it, but I didn't know this because it was actually between my legs under these pads. And very soon after that, they blew the whistle for half time, and off came the protector, and off came the mask, and I never wore them again.
Wonderful, wonderful. We'll stop just now. We'll let you talk afterwards about why you are a Christian, the fun of it, the stresses of it, etc. And we're going to sing another hymn now, and the hymn is going to be Only a Holy God's.
There's none so blind as those that will not see. Has anybody come across this bird box thing where your woman has a blindfold on? She seems to have to do her whole life with a blindfold on in case she might see something. And it's provoked some people trying to do this in real life. People driving their car with a blindfold on. You know, it's a bit stupid. And everyone can see how stupid that is, unless they've also got a blindfold on. We are subject to willful blindness at times, like the emperor's new clothes, the self-deception, the I'm all right because it seems all right to me, and if it feels all right to me, then we can do it, and that's all right. But there's also a disbelief blindness, an underestimating of God, like the two guys on the road to Emmaus who just couldn't really believe that God could do all the things he said he would do. We make our God too small. But when we realize what God can do, even in a small part, the blindfold can come off. We have been living for nearly 17 years in the southwest of Scotland where Jim got a job. And I didn't find that an easy time. It's a lovely place. It's a beautiful place to live. And the people are lovely, but they're not my people. There's things to go on, things to do, things to be involved in, but weren't really my things. And I am afraid slid into depression, which was a very difficult time, very dark time, that wilderness time that I talked about earlier. And it's almost like, you know, there's that blindfold. I became a Christian when I was 14, and I got depression when I was 49. And you'd think in that time that I would have learned enough about God not to despair, not to allow that to happen. But it can happen to anybody. It doesn't matter how long you've been a Christian. It doesn't matter what your circumstances are. You can slide into that very easily. Eventually, I had to say to Jim, I can't take another winter in Wigtown. Something bad would happen, and I wouldn't be responsible for my actions. So he said, okay. much to my surprise, because he was very happy. He had his role and he had his jobs, but he had taken retirement a few months before in order to help with various things. And I said, I can't do this anymore. I can't carry on like this. So he said, okay. He spent the next 4 months tarting up the house. He spent so much time making the house look lovely. I thought, why didn't you do this for the past 14 years? The house looked amazing. But the housing market in that little town of 1,000 people is very small. It's very slow. And I prayed, and I prayed, Lord, if we're not to go, please don't send anybody to buy our house. This is a 5-bedroom detached bungalow with 2 garages, 3 sheds, and a cabin in the garden, 1/2 acre of land, sea view, it's beautiful. If we're not to go, don't send anybody. 6 weeks. And here comes some people from the south of England running away, like many another person does, to Wigtown. Didn't want to be in London anymore. Grown-up children, they didn't care about the school. Online business, as long as their internet worked, they were happy, they didn't care. Here's our money, we don't even have to sell a house, we're in rented. Lord, okay, I get the message. But my parents also lived in Wigtown. They moved over when Rory was just born. So we had 2 houses to sell. 3-bedroom, detached bungalow, sea view, big garden, oh dear. Their house didn't even make it to the market. The Lord had someone lined up for them already. This is the Jungle Drums from Wigtown. Oh, my mum's cousin's looking for a house. It was sold from under them and my father needed oxygen. So we had a house sold. We had another house sold. We needed a house to live in. God provided that as well. Sometimes it's just too good not to be true. God has given us so much. We beg for crumbs, like Dick was saying in the first service. We're not worthy even to get those crumbs. We beg for crumbs and God gives us a banquet. How foolish we are to underestimate our God. The fullness of God is inexhaustible. But it's a hard road. Like I said, it hasn't been easy. And the hardest part is setting out. And we don't want to recognize how foolish we are. And it comes down to pride. I love Mr. Spurgeon. It's hard, he says, it's hard work to go back for Christ. He's talking about Pilgrim having to go back for his scroll. 20 miles onward is easier than to go 1 mile back for the lost evidence. And why is it? It's pride. It's our pride, our hubris, aspiring pride. But what do we have to be proud about? Every good thing we have comes from God. We are foolish and human and we fall into sin again and again, so we have to keep coming back. And the glorious thing about being a Christian is that you can keep coming back. We were again thinking about that this morning in the first service. We forget what God has done for us. We become blasé. We make God as small as us to our cost. But God, in his grace, grants us humility. No one wants to see the people that we love making mistakes. Prevention is better than cure, as every doctor will tell you. And the greatest desire of my heart as a Christian and as a Christian mum is to see my children come to faith, to have that moment of epiphany when the blindfold is taken off through the work of the Holy Spirit. My heart's desire is to know that they are saved and I'm not alone in this room in having that desire for our own families, for our own children, grandchildren. I long to see them walking boldly but humbly in God's ways and the path for their lives. And again, I'll leave the last word to Mr. Spurgeon, who says, no case is hopeless while Jesus lives. And as Wendy reminded us at the prayer meeting, Jesus lives forever. Amen.
Hello again. So you'll already have picked up that I'm from Northern Ireland, as is Lisa. I'm a Northern Irish, small town, evangelical Protestant who went to a Baptist church 4 times on a Sunday, church evangelism fellowship meeting on a Monday, girls' brigade on a Tuesday, scripture union at school on a Thursday, a Brethren youth club on a Friday night, and the church youth club on a Saturday night. On a Wednesday, when there was nothing else on, we prayed extra hard. At least that's what I remember offhand. Most likely those social outings didn't all occur in the 1 week. I must have spanned my life from about 4 to 18, but that was the general pattern. And boy, we couldn't wait until summer, because in summer we had 3 weeks of full-time holiday Bible club. Now, I wouldn't say by any stretch I was browbeaten into becoming a Christian as a small child, but to have not given in would have taken a contrariness I just didn't have then. So I was every Northern Irish parent's, Christian parent's dream. I was compliant, safe, happy, and entirely predictable. You might not like this story. In my mid-teens, at just about the point in my life when we were allowed to wear denim jeans to the evening service, the church appointed a man who was certain that his pastoral role was to stamp his unquestionable authority on the hearts and minds of his congregation. He was a big man, a former rugby player, fierce, and to my mind, a bit like a Russian bear. His word was never to be doubted. His wife was the church organist, and her heart, if not her ability, was in a Mississippi honky-tonk bar. She bounced up and down at the organ, reinterpreting Wesleyan hymns in her own inimitable fashion. It was awful. The one saving grace in this vaudeville horror was the pianist, talented, light-fingered, and as it happened unto her later regret, my sister. And so one night, after another raging sermon about hellfire and damnation, just before the final hymn, and with the church filled to the gills, I could bear it no more, and I unplugged the organ. The pastor just about had a conniption when his normally subservient wife couldn't breathe life into that old beechwood organ, and he commanded my sister to play. And although she didn't know his obscure dirge, she, sensing that I might have had something to do with the lack of control, carried on. It was an entirely unpremeditated moment of rebellion, and for a long time afterwards, I reverted to type, being the compliant, safe Christian woman that God had called me to be. I used to read my Bible, and I pray I would live life more like that of the great men in the Bible, that I would dare to be a Daniel, that I would follow God's call to a strange land like Abraham, that I'd be a fisher of men, that I would return home like the prodigal. And yet, in that same moment, a seed was sown. I discovered you can't ask Jesus into your heart and then hold him there hostage, bound by church standards and inflexible dogma. I discovered, and I'm sure that you've discovered this too, that becoming a Christian is not a one-off decision, but a lifetime of little rebellions, of turnings, and of returnings. And there were many of those. There were many moments when I had to choose between what was good and what was acceptable, between what was just and what was convenient. There were many moments when I had to be honest about what it means to treat everyone as if they're made in the image of God, because they are. And that didn't always square up with how I and how those around me behaved. Now, I don't know about you, but that moment that I dreamt about when I was 15, 16, 17, that moment of finally becoming an adult, was not as thrilling as I'd imagined it would be. Lewis, my smallest boy, used to call adults growing ups, and I love that idea that you never quite fully reach maturity. But there comes a point, usually on a Saturday evening, when you're filling out the car insurance online while stirring a pot of beans with the other hand and stepping on shards of Lego, and your best friend has stood you up again, and your mum, after a long illness, has died, and your core family unit is almost unrecognisable. Comes a point when you think, there's no one else who can live this life for me now. I'm the captain of this ship. I'm the adult. And not only was that moment not thrilling, it was terribly lonely. And did I turn to God for consolation during that chaos? I have to tell you that at that point, I did not. And let me tell you why. Do you remember the story of the disciples in the storm on Lake Galilee? The one where the disciples are desperately trying to bail out the water and Jesus is asleep. And when they wake him, he says, "What have you wakened me for? God's got this under control." I never doubted that God had life under control. I was fully sure of that, that all things would work together for good. But I suspected that Jesus, perhaps personified in the church that we went to, was asleep. And those men of the Bible whom I prayed to be like, Abraham, Daniel, the prodigal boy, with all due respect, they'd never been mothers and carers and school bank packers and part-time workers and birthday party organisers, stretched to breaking point with the very real mundanity of life. I was so busy, we were so busy, Paul and I, trying to bail out the water on our everyday, nappy-filled, work-filled, grief-filled lives, that I just kept going. And eventually, worn out with life, and tired of waiting for God to show up, I give up. I left the church we were attending, although Paul and the boys kept going, and for 6 months, each Sunday morning, I walked through Scotland and Jordan Hill and listened to podcasts for people like me, people who had grown up with a faith which now seemed to be asleep. It was a sort of pilgrimage. It was a prodigal's return of sorts, but not the one you'll be thinking of. Not the young man who left to sow his wild oats and returned to be looked after in the family home, but the Bible's other prodigal. The woman who left home in search of a better life, when she got there, she discovered that all of life had come with her. Her husband died, but in her grief she kept going because her two boys needed her. And she had barely got them raised and married before they died. And she was left alone in a foreign land with two foreign daughters-in-law who depended on her for survival. And as a woman of God, she raised her voice to the sky and shouted, just like Job did, "How could you do this to me, God? What have I ever done to deserve this?" And in her desperation to survive, she decided to go home, to go back to Israel alone. But even then she was thwarted because one of her daughters-in-law, Ruth, wouldn't let her go alone. And for 4 days, they trekked back through across the desert, over the raging Jordan, past the graves of the woman who they had loved and lost many years before, until finally they get to the gates of Bethlehem and her friends rush out to meet her and say, "Naomi, is that really you? You look like you've had a really bad paper round." And Naomi says, "I've been so turned upside down my life, I don't even know my own name anymore." And in the community of those women, in the workers of the field, God shows up. Right there, in and among her neighbours and friends, God shows up. All right, there was the Bible hero I've been looking for all these years. A bitter middle-aged woman who could speak her mind to God and God would listen and God would gather a community around her and bring her home. And actually, and I wasn't going to say this, but actually, the Friday Mum's Bible study, thank you. And so this is my conversion story. It's not the moment I first believed as a small child a whole lifetime ago. It is the many moments of coming to faith along the way. The moments when I discover that God is bigger than the latest box I've put God in. The moments when I come up against real life in all its beauty, despair, and intricate complexities. And I believe that in those moments, when you leave behind all that you've previously comfortably believed, God walks alongside, perhaps in amiable silence, with every step you take back home. Now, you can't sit in a Baptist church for years and years and not end with a challenge to the congregation. So here's mine to you. This week, ask yourself why you're a Christian. And if you're not so keen on the answer you hear back, do something about it. Thanks.
I'm sure, like me, you're impressed with the honesty and the searching that both these women have done to bring to us something of why today they are still Christians. Part of the answer to that, I'm sure, is sitting in front of me. That group of Christian men and women who have been the supports, the comforts, the lifters, the helpers. And that's what we are as a church. That's what we are. And I hope that we will continue to be that. We're going to close with a final hymn. And this hymn asks a question. Who can know the mind of our Creator? Who can know what God is thinking? If you had been listening to Lisa and Leanne, that's a question that must have flooded through. What is going on, God?